Allman Brothers there to start out Live Music Friday. We want to thank John Brown, Tom Brown, and Dave Fitzpatrick for providing the live music here in Studio S on a Live Music Friday here on WKAR. They are the three members of Shelby Ann Marie's band, who is our special Live Music Friday guest here today. Shelby made it through Hollywood Week on American Idol here a few years back. She's a 2015 Portland High School graduate, and we'll be hearing Shelby Ann sing with this great band several times here before the hour's through on Current State on WKAR. Glad you could make it along today. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the top of the program, anticipation is building for the Republican and Democratic national conventions. Both are coming up this month. As the gatherings near, efforts to unite both parties persist. Those efforts are nonetheless playing out amid reports of a Republican effort to stop likely nominee Donald Trump. And both frontrunners will soon be announcing their vice presidential candidates. To help us understand all of that and more, we welcome back Matt Grossman. Matt's an associate professor of political science here at Michigan State. And Matt's next book is due out next month, by the way. It's called Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats. Matt Grossman, good to see you.
Good morning.
The GOP convention is the week after next. Just yesterday, the Wall Street Journal reported on one last push by anti-Trump Republicans to free up delegates to back whoever they want, unbinding them from Donald Trump. This is a behind-the-scenes long shot, according to the story in the Wall Street Journal, and we've been hearing about scenarios like this. What do you think of this possibility?
There's a lot more intrigue than usual, but this isn't likely to change the outcome. Trump will be the Republican nominee. The way the rules are set up currently, they allow people to, however people vote, their votes are going to be recorded as they were elected in primaries and caucuses. So there may be a conscience exemption that allows a few people to formally not vote for Trump, but it won't change the outcome. Mm.
Well, the numbers, not just from the Wall Street Journal story, but from other sources, suggest that this effort could clear the first hurdle. And it all boils down to the RNC's Rules Committee. If a quarter of the Rules Committee supports the idea of unbinding the delegates, then it would apparently put it in front of the entire convention. That's 28 people. And I guess the head count, is it about, I don't know, they've done a couple of head counts. It's around 20 right now.
We could possibly have a full convention vote. I don't think it would succeed. I think it's much more likely that the compromise will be that individual delegates can have their votes recorded as being against Trump, but not changing the overall delegate totals.
Well, it gets one to thinking, though, whether the calculus might change if it clears that first hurdle. If the 28 members of the Rules Committee vote to do that, are delegates who are preparing to back Trump apt to reconsider their options if it clears that first hurdle? What do you think? I guess it's a psychological question here.
Well, it's fun for us to play out the scenarios, but the bottom line is that there's not support for anyone else to be the nominee, and the problem all along has been you can't beat somebody with nobody, and there hasn't been anybody that has majority support in the delegates other than Trump. So Trump will remain the nominee, whatever the rules changes are.
What do you make of Donald Trump's inability to unite the GOP?
Well, the electorate is actually uniting fairly quickly. He has high levels of support among Republicans in the electorate, comparable to Mitt Romney at a similar period. So it's really the elites that are slow to come on board, although they are doing so slowly. There are still more holdouts among elected officials than is usual at this time. But, of course, Trump is a very unconventional nominee, so that shouldn't be too surprising.
We'll return to the Republicans here in just a minute, but I want to ask you about the impact that this week had the FBI's not recommending charges to be filed against Hillary Clinton on the server issue. What impact or impacts do you think that may have?
Well, the short-term impact is negative for Hillary Clinton. It's another reminder that voters see her as untrustworthy and that the FBI chief has given them new reasons to do so. But in the long term, it's good news for Hillary Clinton. She won't have the cloud of a possible indictment over her for the campaign, and the issue is mostly resolved at this point. So it'll be a bad couple of days for her in news, but for the general election, it's overall a good sign for Hillary Clinton.
Short-term bad news, longer-term better news. It's interesting to parse the response among Democrats, especially among Sanders supporters. One Sanders supporter from Ohio, Mr. Guy Smith, posted on Facebook, quote, "We are entitled to oust Clinton and demand Bernie as our Democratic choice in light of the corruption FBI Director Comey exposed Clinton on, demand it at the convention." How do you think that could play out in Philadelphia?
Well, some people never give up, but that was true last time as well of some Clinton supporters at the convention who wanted to not give up on Obama being the nominee. So I don't expect a lot of intrigue at the Democratic convention. I expect Bernie Sanders to endorse her before then. And Bernie Sanders, people who voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary are very likely to end up voting for Hillary Clinton in the general election. And levels of support for Clinton among Sanders supporters are already higher than were levels of support among Clinton supporters for Obama at this period in 2008. Mm.
Very interesting to compare those general elections. It's still interesting, though, on Reddit, according to a story in the New York Times, one Reddit user wondered, why isn't Bernie saying more about this? Quote, "The director of the FBI has given so much ammunition." I have to ask, Matt, if you were advising the Sanders campaign, would you advise them to make more out of the FBI investigation?
Yes, I think it was not at this point, it's too late, but I think it was a critical mistake for him to intervene in that debate and say he was tired of hearing about it, since it was one of people's primary concerns about Hillary Clinton and reinforced all the negative personal attributes that she has in public opinion, that she was untrustworthy, that she was out for herself. So it was a chance to advance all of those storylines, and he decided not to go for that.
We are updating what's happening in the U.S. presidential race ahead of this month's conventions. Our guest is MSU Associate Professor of Political Science, Matt Grossman. Matt also heads up IPSR, the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research here at Michigan State, and his next book is due out next month. Let's also update this dance going on between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Mr. Sanders appears to be, well, he's taken his time, I guess, to formally get behind her. That is expected soon, from what I understand, maybe at an appearance in New Hampshire next week. But all the while here, he is trying to influence the party platform. Do you expect the platform that emerges from Philadelphia to really noticeably include any of Senator Sanders' issues or priorities?
Well, he's already gotten something out of waiting. Hillary Clinton has changed her position in his direction on higher education, promising a free higher education in-state tuition. With a similar implementation as Sanders' plan. And very explicitly, Clinton said that she was borrowing from Sanders' plan because of talks with Sanders. So that's a success. I don't expect too many additional changes. The platform is pretty much done at this point. So he's gotten what he can get, and it sounds like he's ready to endorse.
The new Clinton proposal also, according to reports, would offer free tuition at public schools to students and families earning $85,000 a year or less at first, and that threshold increasing to $125,000. It would also feature a three-month grace period for students to refinance their loans.
Right, so that second part could actually be implemented directly by Clinton in the executive branch, so that's important. The first part would require a lot of action from state legislatures that might not be forthcoming.
The Detroit News reported yesterday to get back to Donald Trump here, the Detroit News reported yesterday that Trump's political organization has only one full-time staffer right now in the state of Michigan. The story said that Hillary Clinton is prepared to deploy as many as 200 field staff soon here in our state. How important is that staff? How important are those resources?
Well, we have evidence that numbers of field offices matter for turnout and general election outcomes, and that paid staff also can make a difference in vote counts.
How exactly? Connect the dots there.
Well, it's mostly through voter contact. We find that the more you are contacted by the campaigns, the more you're likely to turn out and to some extent support that candidate. They make a difference, but there's always some differentiation on the numbers. The Republican Party always claims that its numbers are undercounted because the Democrats count party staff differently than candidate staff. But the bottom line is that Clinton will have a lot more on-the-ground people than Trump.
Yeah. The Trump campaign's approach is apparently to forego hiring staff to work the state and to get out the vote. Instead, it will authorize the Republican National Committee to organize a staff for the campaign. Here in Michigan, the news story citing 34 RNC staff to be assigned to Michigan, 7 from the state organization. What do you make of that approach? Why this approach?
Well, I'm not sure it's an approach so much as just what's left. If he doesn't have his own campaign organized in Michigan, he'll have to rely on the party regulars. But it's always tough to know how many of those people would have been here anyway and how many are actually being assigned to help the Trump campaign. I think in the end, Hillary Clinton will have a massive advantage both in advertising and in on-the-ground field operations, really unparalleled in contemporary political history. Mm. This big of a difference between the major party candidates. Mm.
I take it hired staff also will play a role in getting out the vote for down ticket contests. There's been a lot of talk about that. What do you see there?
Absolutely. The presidential election is our highest turnout election, and it's swing states generally have turnout that ends up being 5 or 6 percentage points higher. So that makes a big difference to down party candidates. And it also matters how many times people are contacted, whether they turn out.
You expect a lot of robocalls?
Well, we actually don't have evidence that robocalls are helpful, but that hasn't deterred people from calling us regularly.
No
with those robocalls. But we've actually found that a personal conversation makes a lot bigger difference. Having people actually call people live or show up at your door makes a bigger difference for turnout.
Professor Matt Grossman is our guest. Matt's an associate professor here at Michigan State in the Department of Political Science. Now, we'll be hearing more vice presidential chatter here in the next few days. How important is the VP selection in Trump's case, for starters?
Well, vice presidential selections are usually overrated for their potential impact on the election. They can at times be very important for governance, of course.
I'm wondering, though, with two candidates with as high a negatives as they both have, if whether or not the vice presidential selection might be of greater relevance this year. Is that possible?
Well, but we also have two very strong and well-known personalities at the top of the ticket, so it'll be hard for the vice presidential candidates to dominate voter decision-making. I think people will look to see if the vice presidential candidates are competent. We do have some evidence that vice presidential candidates can move home state voters if they're very popular there, so that may be a reason for Hillary to pick someone from Ohio or Virginia. But we don't have a lot of evidence that people vote on vice presidential nominees.
Indeed, one candidate for Hillary Clinton is from Ohio, Senator Sherrod Brown. Remind our listeners here who is on the short list for Trump. I'm seeing here Chris Christie, Newt Gingrich, Joni Ernst of Iowa, and Mike Pence of Indiana. Any thoughts on those choices?
Right. Well, Joni Ernst has sort of taken herself out of consideration or made moves in that direction. So if I had to guess now, I'd guess Newt Gingrich. He's well positioned with Trump in demeanor, and he's been loyal to him, but Christie has been as well, and Mike Pence is sort of a more traditional vice presidential pick. So yeah. Any of those are possible, and he's actually having them out on the trail to give them a chance to show their stuff.
I have to ask you about the scene last week. We had Secretary Clinton and Senator Elizabeth Warren appearing in Cincinnati. That had a lot of Democrats really fired up. Some number of them would, no doubt, would love to see Warren as the vice presidential selection. Is that possible? Is that likely? What do you think?
It's possible if they decide to go for buzz over anything else, then they could pick Warren. But it doesn't seem very likely to move any voter groups who aren't already strongly on Clinton's side.
It appears the others on the short list for Senator Clinton, Tim Kaine, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, Labor Secretary Thomas Perez, Elizabeth Warren, and Senator Cory Booker was talked about there for a while as well. Also, California Congressman Xavier Becerra, also on that list. Any other? Where should she go here? What do you think?
Well, it seems like she's thinking about nominating a Latino vice president. She has three potential nominees on the list from that voter group. But it seems mostly like she'll go for a swing state, well-known individual, and might end up being a fairly boring pick, but one that'll give her some strength in governing.
What, how closely do you follow the polling here? I see the New York Times. The Times calculates a national polling average. Yesterday, it showed a 4 percentage point lead for Hillary Clinton, 43% to 39%. How do you view these polls?
Well, they're actually fairly predictive at this point, right before the conventions. But you're about to see some changes because both conventions tend to give momentary bumps to each candidate. So you'll likely see some ups and downs in coming weeks. But the big my big takeaway from those numbers, 43-39, is that there's still a lot of people who are claiming to be undecided, and that includes people who have voted for Democrats or Republicans four elections in a row. And we pretty much know how they're going to vote. So a lot of those people claiming to be undecided, it's pretty clear how they're going to end up voting.
Always fun to talk to you, Matt. We want to thank our guest, Associate Professor of Political Science here at Michigan State, Matt Grossman. His new book is due out next month, Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats. Matt Grossman, thank you.
Thank you.
Follow another heart that's turning shallow. A world obsessed with looks and movies over books. More worry about the post than what truly means the most. Whatever happened to the families now? That is all a fantasy. But I wanna go back, back to long walks and long talks on the floor. I wanna go back. Back to when a house was still a home. A memory that's past but never gone. So we say that we want change, but don't have time to rearrange. Too busy staring at our screens and seeing things that shouldn't be seen. We'll leave it to the young, our daughters and our sons, to make the right. And if they want someone else mine, but I wanna go back, back to long walks and long talks on the floor. I wanna go back, back to when a house was still a home. A memory that's past but never gone. I want the old time. Black and white, everywhere I look, we're drunk, made right. I want a gentleman that's worth the fight. I'm still hoping someday somebody might. Cause I wanna go back, back to long walks and long talks on the phone. I wanna go back, back to when a house was still a home. A memory that's past but never gone. I wanna go back, back to long walks and long talks on the phone. I wanna go back, back to when a house was still a home.
Shelby Ann Marie on Live Music Friday here on WKAR's Current State. That an original composition?
Yes, that
okay,
was.
Okay, well done.
Thank you.
How many songs have you written?
Over 50 by now.
Over 50. Wow, not bad. Not bad. Well, we'll hear more music here in just a little bit. Shelby Ann Marie, backed up by John Brown, Tom Brown, and Dave Fitzpatrick here today in, live in Studio S on WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. The 4th of July, 1866 was an especially memorable one in Michigan. On that Independence Day, Michigan Governor Harry Crapo was in Detroit's Campus Martius to accept the battle flags of Michigan's Civil War volunteers. That event drew 70,000 people, an astounding 7% of the state's entire population at the time. The day's not been forgotten. Its 150th anniversary will be marked at the state capitol on Saturday. Current State Scott Pohl talks with Dave Downing of Save the Flags, a 25-year-old organization that works to preserve those Civil War battle flags. Downing describes the vibrant scene in Detroit on July 4th, 1866.
The whole premise was that the veterans of all the Michigan regiments, artillery, infantry, cavalry, and even the sailors were coming to Detroit as a kind of a big reunion. And the whole impetus was that the veterans, all of them, had decided that they were going to turn over the battle flags that they had carried into battle with them. They were going to turn them over to the state. And the state had plans to house them in a Civil War museum type thing, which is eventually what they built here in Lansing at the Capitol. So that's what happened. And they marshaled together and they marched, you know, down the street, and they, in a ceremony, turned over the flags to the governor.
What kind of condition were the flags in, having been in battle?
Well, that's one of the really interesting things about going through the collection. Is there are flags that had seen a lot of wear and tear. There were flags that had been through the thickest of the battle. There were flags that were made specifically for the Grand Review, which is what the soldiers did in May of 1865, right after the war was over. They brought all of the armies both together in Washington, D.C., and had a grand march. Well, a lot of the regiments made special flags for that. So some of the flags that were turned over to the state in 1866 were those flags that they had made up back then. One of the interesting things about the collection is that on the flags themselves, they have battle honors. It's one of the things that you first notice when you're looking at some of the Civil War flags. They'll have the actual names of the battles that the regiments were, you know, were engaged in. And a lot of people don't realize that they were not allowed to put those battle honors on the flags by themselves. They had to get permission from the commander. And they had to prove that they were in the fighting and that they didn't retreat. They didn't show dishonor or anything, but they fought bravely. So that's how they got those battle honors on there.
I want to make clear, we're not just talking about wear and tear. Some of them were damaged in battle. They were shot.
Yeah, exactly.
Bled on, maybe.
Yeah, we can't know for certain, but there are several flags that certainly do look bloodstained. And we know we have accounts of flag bearers that were shot in the head. And the description was that, you know, it was splattered on the flag. And those kinds of things, you know, that just makes the collection even more special.
I'm glad you brought up the flag bearers, because that was a special breed. That took a special kind of bravery. Mm-hmm. One thinks of flag bearers as being, I don't know, maybe comparing to the people who carry the flags with a marching band or something like this. This right. was among the most dangerous duties you could be assigned to.
It certainly was. There were nine men that were part of what was called the Color Guard. And they were standing in the center of the regiment. And there were two of them in the Union Army. There were two flags that were carried, one national and one regimental, which is basically the state flag. And the purpose of the two color bearers and the seven other men there were to protect those flags. So the ones that were there not carrying flags but had rifles, it was their duty to protect the flags. And should one of the color bearers be shot, it was their duty to drop the rifle and pick the flag up.
Drop a rifle and pick up the flag.
That's right. And they didn't shoot their rifles during a battle, only in defense of the flag. So to capture a flag was probably one of the worst things you could have happen to a regiment, because that was a lot of these flags were made by the ladies or the citizens of the town that they came from, and you know they were done in, they were presented in big special ceremonies before all of these men marched off to war, so they were extremely special.
We're talking with Dave Downing. He's with the group Save the Flags. On Saturday, events are planned at the state capitol to commemorate the return of Michigan Civil War volunteers and their battle flags. To the best of our knowledge, how many of these flags remain?
In our collection, we have 160 Civil War flags.
And by our collection, we should explain.
It's the state of Michigan.
Right, right. Okay.
They're housed in a special environmentally controlled atmospheric room in the museum. We take people in there to view the flags. Maybe we could back up a little bit about the Save the Flags project.
Sure.
When the Capitol was first going to be restored back in 1989-1990, if people remember, those flags were hanging in cases in the rotunda. And there are still flags there, but they are reproductions of the ones that are in the collection. So it was a decision of, were we going to let the flags stay there, or should we take them out and try to preserve them the best we can? Because Governor Prepo promised back in 1866 that the flags would be preserved forever for the people of the state of Michigan. So we decided it was probably best to take the flags out and try to lay them flat and try to stop the deterioration. In the rotunda, at one point, they allowed smoking. So that was a designated smoking area.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly not good for material like, you know, cotton and silk, which is what the flags are made out of.
They got a certain amount of sunlight there, too.
Yeah, and they got sunlight. And we were told that they were airtight, but they weren't when we got to the point of taking the flags out. So right now we took, and when we opened up the cases, we saw all sorts of bits and pieces of silk, and we saw red, white, and blue powder, which is kind of evidence of silk as it deteriorates. That's what happens to it. So we knew we were doing the right thing when we took them out and laid them flat on basically what looks like a huge bread sheet, and put them on acid-free paper, and were preserving them. There were several that we found that were folded up and stuffed in a box. They were going to be preserved back in the 60s, but they ran out of funds. So we inherited some of these, what we called flag in a box, and we couldn't figure out what they were, and had them sent out. And we've since, I think we've got most of them done by now.
And the group Save the Flags was formed 25 years ago.
Yes, yep.
You've been with them from the start?
From the start. We have what's called a flag adoption program with Save the Flags. For $1,000, you can adopt a flag. And my family was the first one. As soon as we heard about it, I was there in reenactor uniform when they were taking the flags out of the rotunda. We acted as kind of a guard to help them. And they actually allowed me at the time to carry some of the flags out of the cases, which is like one of those life moments, you know. So, and I got to carry two of the flags that my ancestor fought under out of the case and lay them flat. And that was, that was just electric for me anyway.
These events at the Capitol on Saturday, Dave, they include Civil War reenactors like you. You've been a Civil War reenactor for many years. What will the reenactors be doing on Saturday at the Capitol?
We're going to be marching in and basically commemorating the original ceremony that happened. And there's going to be some other groups there along with reenactors. There'll be infantry. We're going to have a couple of artillery batteries there that will fire a salute. Sons of Union veterans will be there, which is basically the the sons of the original members of the Grand Army of the Republic, which was the veterans organization of Union soldiers. And we'll also have a contingent of National Guard. So, and General Slocum from the Michigan Air Guard is going to be one of our featured speakers, and he is actually going to be the one that will physically receive the flags. We're having several reenactor groups retire their reproduction flags, and we're going to be using them for demonstration and educational purposes with Save the Flags.
People always wonder at Civil War reenactments if the Confederacy will be represented, because that comes with no small amount of controversy for some. Will the Confederacy be represented?
They won't be here at this event because they weren't there in 1866. This was a Union state.
Save the Flags events marking the sesquicentennial of the return of Michigan's Civil War battle flags will be at the state capitol in Lansing Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., complete with reenactors, demonstrations, and music. Dave Downing is with Save the Flags. Dave, thank you.
Thank you very much, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
We'll also point out that the Save the Flags events at the state capitol are from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. tomorrow. The main ceremony will start at 1 o'clock. Well, Shelby Ann Marie is our Live Music Friday guest here today on Current State. Shelby's 18 years old. She's already making a name for herself in country music. She's a 2015 Portland St. Patrick graduate. She made it through to Hollywood Week on American Idol already three whole years ago. And she's got quite a bit of performing experience under her belt already at the age of 18. Let's hear Shelby Ann Marie and her band. This is called You and Me.
Trying hard just not to cry. Maybe we just need some time. Can't believe it's turning out this way. All this time I thought I knew just who we were, and so did you, but suddenly that's changing every day. And I don't know what to think anymore. But I don't want to walk out that door. And let them fade. Tomorrow is a brand new day, and everything gets better in the light. His eyes say sorry, Mel says please. Baby, you're the one I need, and all things good are always worth a fight. But I don't know what to think anymore. You are everything I need.
Shelby Ann Marie, live here in Studio S. It's called You and Me, so ably backed up here by John Brown on guitar, Tom Brown on rhythm guitar, John on lead, Tom on rhythm, Dave Fitzpatrick on bass. Our formal welcome here to WKAR. It's nice to have you here today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Let's talk about how you got into music. You're just 18 now. How old were you when you knew you really could sing?
I mean, my mom always tells the story. I was in preschool, literally, when I first started singing, and we had kind of just sang around the house as a family and everything. And I made it when I was in kindergarten. I was in a talent show, and my mom had brought it to the attention of my music teacher, and she's like, you know, she really just loves singing, and I want to develop this. What's the best way to go about that? And my music teacher said, you know, just let her do her own thing. Don't put her in lessons or anything.
Yeah, but how well could you sing as a kindergartner?
I mean, I don't know. Apparently my mom thought pretty good. But after that, I started singing in choir when I was in second grade and started leading in masses and doing different things at really just a young age. And so it really all started there. Started doing the national anthem when I was in fourth grade for different basketball games and
so you felt you felt you could sing from just an absurdly early age.
I don't know if I felt I could sing, but I knew I loved doing it. So
well, okay. It's always seemed to me that singers are born, not made. Do you tend to agree with that?
I do. I think everyone has something that they're passionate about, and some people it takes a while to figure out what that is, but for me it was very natural, and I knew that's something that I always wanted to do. Grew up singing, like I said, and everybody knew about it. As soon as I turned 15, they were like, happy birthday, and when are you auditioning for American Idol?
Wow.
So it was just something that was really ingrained in me.
Yeah, a lot of people backing you up here, obviously. What appeals to you about country music?
I think for me, it's really just the lyrically based music that country music has. A lot of the pop music now, it's just a different way to go about writing and performing it. A lot of the pop music starts with a track and then they fit lyrics to match the beat that they want. And country music really works the opposite way. You start with the lyrics and the story that you want to build and then go on from there. And so that's something that really appealed to me, is how much you can reach out and tell a story through the country music.
I imagine it was on the radio at your house when you were growing up.
Yeah, we had a little bit of everything going on, but I was definitely drawn to country music.
What was some of the other stuff that you heard, though?
Oh, we really had everything. I mean, pop music, rock music, just really everything. Yeah. My sister will tell you, she's like a hardcore rap fan, and I'm like the total opposite. But I definitely have a lot of influences from different genres in my music.
When you were 15, you were a contestant. You made it through Hollywood Week on American Idol, just short of the top 30. You turned 16 during that time. Tell us about that time. What was that? Well, the whole experience like?
The whole experience. It was definitely a learning experience, first of all. And so I started out, like I said, when I was 15, I knew I wanted to audition. And my mom was very supportive, but she also is realistic about things. And so there is a whole list of different paperwork that you needed to have and contracts needed to be signed before you could even audition. And so I had that ready the next day for her and was ready to go. And then just went through the audition process, made it through Hollywood Week and working with groups. And that was the first time I was with a band. And so just all different kinds of things that you're really thrown into. It's kind of a crash course in the music industry.
I guess so. How many different times did you perform in your American Idol chapter here? How many different times?
Let's see. There was
about
4 auditions before I made it to the judges. So those were kind of the preliminary auditions with the producers. Then I went through 1 audition with the judges before making it to Hollywood Week, and then about, I think it was 3 performances while I was in Hollywood. So a whole bunch of stuff.
Nerve-wracking? I mean, did the nerves get dialed up a lot once you were in Los Angeles?
Oh, absolutely. And you're going off no sleep. They kind of feed off of that pressure, and so they're throwing you in situations that you never thought you'd be in.
Yeah. Well, let's hear another song here. Shelby Ann Marie is our musical guest here on Current State's Live Music Friday. This is a track called I See.
The street is never the same. Something's never quite right. You see a house on a hill. All I see is a fight. I'm
you'll say. Sing what you will at the end of the day. Yeah. I see a little girl in mama's world. Her daddy's living hell. A hidden truth, nothing to lose. You so much left to tell. It all and can't let nobody see the fear that's inside, the scars that are deep. Every word, every move is overanalyzed. She's waiting to hear the next goodbye. I see a little girl in mama's world, her daddy's living hell. A hidden truth, nothing to lose, you so much left to tell. Tears, they still hide deep down inside. La da da, la da da, la da da da, la da da, la da da, la da da da. Afraid of the past and what is to come. Life is moving too fast, and she's trying to keep up, so she'll say another prayer, hope and pray to God he is everywhere. I see a little girl in mama's world, a brand new life. A hidden truth, nothing to lose, she'll make the wrong right. Yeah, her daddy gave her those eyes, but she's got her mama's smile and she's doing just fine. La da da.
I see Shelby Ann Marie here on Current State's Live Music Friday. She is our guest today, along with her band, John and Tom Brown on guitars and bass player Dave Fitzpatrick. Do you you must work with a drummer occasionally here. You don't have one today. But...
Yeah, he's at work.
Okay.
So
understood.
Yeah, we usually have a full band with a drummer and everything. These guys are very supportive and always backing me up and have definitely made me a better artist, I think.
Well, you all sound fantastic today. I find it so exciting to ask you about your planned move to Nashville in September. What's the game plan exactly? How do you want this to go?
I mean, obviously we all have those dreams. Anyone that moves to Nashville, you want to hit it big right away. But it works differently for every person. So I'm hoping just to be able to get into the writers' rounds and get into different meetings. I've been meeting with some agents at CAA Nashville.
Writers' rounds, what are those?
Yeah, so it's basically when a bunch of writers just come together and perform at different locations and you kind of switch back and forth during the set. And so just getting that experience with different artists. And
like an open mic night.
Basically, yeah.
I'm kind of reluctant to ask, is the band going with you or are you going to be picking up some new players here?
No, I'm trying to convince
them
still.
Sad. That's kind of sad.
Yeah, I'll be back and forth from Michigan and Nashville. We have some shows lined up still next year, so I'll be back with them. But
do you know where you're going to live and all of this basic kind of stuff?
I'm looking at apartments when I go down, probably going down in August to kind of finalize where I'm going to be staying, but yeah. Looking at a few different places right now.
We usually talk about upcoming gigs. We always talk about upcoming gigs, but I see most of the events on your schedule this summer are private. How can people go to see you besides crashing a private event?
You know, we just got done with quite a few public events. We were playing up in Traverse City for the Cherry Festival. Opening for Kane Brown, and I've done quite a few different things. We were just in Portland last night playing at the Banchel. So kind of wrapping it up for the summer, like I said, planning on moving soon. And I'm also planning on doing a tour, a bit of an acoustic tour in Virginia and West Virginia in the middle of August. So kind of trying to figure all that out as well as keeping playing, but
gotcha.
We have stuff coming up.
So. How much recording have you done?
I've done a little bit of recording, not too much. Live performances are definitely my strong suit, but I've recorded a few things in the studio just to get a feel for it. Still a learning process for sure.
Shelby Ann Marie is our Live Music Friday guest here, along with her players, Dave Fitzpatrick on bass and guitarist John and Tom Brown. You write a lot of your songs. What sort of things inspire your songwriting?
Definitely my past inspires a lot of it, and going through high school. I mean, I'm still 18, so I don't have too much life experience, but I write about as much as I can. Music is definitely
You'll be
how
a heck of a songwriter when you're as old as the rest of your band. Let's just put it that way.
I hope so. But it's a learning experience as well. I use music to get through a lot of things, and so that's really how I portray my emotion, and I don't talk about a lot of things, so music is how I get that out.
But you've told me your faith is important in your life. Does that connect to your music
in some way? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. My faith is really the center of everything that I do. And, I mean, even when I was on American Idol, I was bringing it to my mom's attention. I was like, what if this isn't God's plan and what I'm not supposed to be doing? Like, I was just very concerned about that. And I think that we all have a purpose and we all have a reason that we're in the place that we are. And so I really try to be a positive influence in my community as well as the communities that I reach out to. And I wouldn't be able to do that without my faith. It's what keeps me grounded and what keeps me, you know, going through it all. So.
You were in Portland at the time of the tornado, I presume.
Yes.
Were you involved in the community then? Or, I mean, how did that impact you?
Yeah, we're actually like a block from where the major damage was. And so we really saw it all firsthand, and we're out there. As soon as everything was cleared, we were out there helping to, you know, just clean up the community, and it was crazy. You never think it's going to happen to your community, and we really just banded together, and then I ended up doing a community concert to try to raise money to help rebuild the churches and different things in the community as
Terrific.
Well.
Terrific. What's been your most exciting gig so far? Is there one you'd put at the top, or have there been so many you couldn't pick one?
I mean, every performance is a great opportunity, and I'm blessed to have all the opportunities that I have. One that really comes to mind is the first time that I actually played with the band that I'm working with now. We got to open for Craig Morgan and Chase Rice at the Fifth Third Ballpark. And just being on that stage, that was the first time that I really got to perform for an audience like that.
And Grand Rapids.
It was great. So
you've opened for some top country acts, Trace Adkins, the band Perry. When you're on a bill like that, do you get to interact with the headliners here and their bands, and does that happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it depends on the artist, how they run a show. But for example, when we were up in Traverse City, we worked with the Kane Brown and his band, and it was for the 4th of July. So I ended up watching fireworks with them, and you know, just getting advice. And I try to make connections and take advice from wherever
sure.
I can get it. So it's always nice to have.
Well, we want to thank you for making our Friday really special here. You sound fantastic. Your band sounds great. Shelby Ann Marie has been our Live Music Friday guest, and band members include John and Tom Brown on guitars, who we figured out this morning I may have played football against many, many, many years ago. When Ovid Elsie used to play Portland St. Patrick. My gosh, this is bizarre. John and Tom Brown on guitars, and bassist Dave Fitzpatrick. Shelby is heading to Nashville. We're going to have Shelby Ann Marie play us out here on Current State. We wish everybody a great weekend and best of luck to all of you.
Another call, another fight, another here we go again. Push and pull away and then you fall right back. And all she says and all she does, saying that she's in love, but telling you you're still just friends. She see all that I do, everything I see in you, who it is that you run to. What would I tell her if I could? Well, all I know is that she should them before I do. He'll play it off and let it go, thinking that I don't know what it is that she's doing to him. But I can see him, so can she, that him and her weren't meant to be. She better get to going on her leave.